It's on. Well, welcome. Come on in. Find a seat. Welcome to Starstruck in Deep Water. Hopefully you will all be blessed by this. This actually came about sort of as a personal desire of mine. I called up my brother John, who has, of course, been talking about creation for a long, long time, and actually got me interested in it. And I said, hey, it'd be fun to do a seminar together at Faith Walkers. And I knew if he asked, they'd let him do it. They'd let us do it. So, and it has been a desire of mine. I was an engineer. I was an electrical engineer. And my brother is the one that's responsible. John is responsible for bringing me to the Lord. I was a very lost 20-year-old, and he very persistently shared the Lord with me and brought me to the church through, even though I had no interest in it, but he very faithfully, lovingly shared Christ and the church with me and ended up with me dedicating my life to building the church. But as an engineer, of course, I was a very scientifically minded person, and my brother was a biology major. And he also had questions about, can we believe the beginning of the Bible? And so he was very active at Iowa State University. And one of the first things I remember is he invited me to go see Dr. A.E. Wilder Smith, whom he invited to come to Iowa State. And if you've never heard of him, he's now deceased. But he had more earned doctorates than any person in history. And I had never seen a man like this who scientifically could back up the Bible. And it has become for me very foundational to my faith. I think for all of us, if we are going to act on our faith, then it has to be reality. And that's really what I'm going to be talking about today. And my portion of this is it reality? Is what you and I believe, is it reality? Because how many of you learned, let me just ask this quick. Anybody here learn the Billy Goat's Gruff when you were a little kid? Okay, some of you. How about the Goldilocks and the Three Bears? Okay, that one made it. When I was a kid, everybody learned the old lady in the shoe. A few. Yeah, see, when I was a kid, all of us learned every one of those myths. It was mandatory that you learn those myths as a child. How many of you know about the Big Bang? Yeah, every one of you. Because that has become our cultural myth. That is what has replaced what we teach our children about the world. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about today, is that reality? Does that really define reality, or is that just what we've decided to tell everybody as a child? So we're going to be doing this together. So I'm going to be talking about the Big Bang and sort of the whether that's really a plausible way for everything to have gotten here or not. And John is going to talk about
the flood. Okay. So we're both going to give just a little bit of an intro here. Then Charlie's going to share some stuff about astronomy. He did call me up. He said, hey, let's do this seminar together, and mentioned the subject that he's been studying up on lately, which relates to astronomy. And I have been doing a number of things related to the flood. And those two make a great package. Some of you all are here because you are engaged with this issue, so you'll have a lot of background information. Some of you are here and don't have that background information. And so all we can do, it's like teaching, let's teach the history of the United States and the history of Russia together in one seminar. All you're going to get is a few trinkets of facts. But for those of us that have the background knowledge, it is incredibly, incredibly exciting. And I think there's more and more seminars on this subject. The Faith Walkers this year has lots and lots of things on origins. And I think that's for two reasons. One, people realize increasingly that it's very important. And two, when you get familiar with this stuff, it is so much fun and so exciting, you just want to teach it. And so I think that's why we're seeing in part what we saw here at our own conference. So, I just want to say just a word or two about these two subjects before we let Charlie go. This is a great set of bookends, because he's going to talk about astronomy. And the Bible talks a fair amount about astronomy. And God uses astronomy to show us how big he is. And most of us know very little about astronomy. If you really studied it, one of the things that would overwhelm your mind to the point where there'd be times where you'd be speechless as it came into your comprehension of what you're beginning to grasp is how huge the universe is. It is supposedly about, and there's reason to think this is true, about 42 billion light years across. Unimaginably vast. And there are people who study astronomy and they say the reason they cannot believe in God is they cannot conceive of a God bigger than the universe. They said back when everyone thought that the world was very small and the universe was very small, people conceived of these gods that ran the universe, but now we know it is so immensely vast. How could there be a being that big? And when you really look at astronomy, you have to face that question. Do you really believe that God is bigger than that? And if he is, God is so big, there is nothing in your life that is not infinitesimally small compared to God. And I know for me, getting a little bit of glimpse of astronomy, I go, oh my goodness. And I worry. I wonder if God can deal with my issues. God is that big. And we're the first generation in the history of the world that has ever known that. Do you know how many stars they believed there were 300 years ago? 1,800. 1,800 stars. They counted them. It was 1842. Different guys had different numbers, but it was 1,800 and some. That's all you could see. Back when people talked about the multitude of the stars, all they could see is 1,800 of them. We now know what God has let us see about himself. The heavens declare the glory of God. Is that what they're declaring? Then, oh my goodness, what a glory. Then there's the flood. So we got this immense God. And the question we really need to have in our world is, okay, so there he is way out there, 42 billion light years away. Where is he now? And if the flood of Noah really happened, then God has been right here. That God has been right here, right in our midst, responding to us. He's been responding to what we do. That God. We're not talking about things way back in the 6 days of creation, which I believe is of course true and very defensible. God was in our world, in our history, in our time, messing with us. And you and I can take a message for our own lives away from that. So these two things, astronomy, the flood, they're amazing things. And I just, you know, I hope this whets your appetite a little bit. I think this is going to be a really fun last seminar. I've got about 60,000 pictures to flash by you. And that's all that I'm going to be able to do. But you find God here in this subject of origins in a way you can almost touch him. And that's what he intended, and that's what's been taken away from us. A tangible God. He's your God, and he's there, and he gave us evidence, and the world's trying to cover it up. So, that's why so many people like this subject.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to have to speed through this. We're going to... I just want to give credit to this. Most of my thoughts here came out of a book called Dismantling the Big Bang by Alex Williams and John Hartnett. Excellent book. I think every Christian should read it. I got some of the best theological thoughts I have gotten in years out of this book. It's a very spiritual, well-written book. So anyway, here we go. What are we looking at here? Does anybody know what this photo is? Hubble Ultra Deep Field. Somebody said deep field. This is the ultra deep field. And this is, in my opinion, the most amazing photograph ever created by man. To get this photograph, they had to put this Hubble Space Telescope in orbit first. Once that was there, they took a spot in the sky where they thought there was no stars. And they shined the Hubble telescope on an area of the sky about the size of a quarter, 10 feet away, and discovered galaxies that they didn't know were there. And then to get this photograph, they took one of the blackest places in that picture, and they shined the Hubble telescope on that, from September 24th to January 16th, 2003 to 2004, supposedly looking back 13 billion light years. It's taken a section of the sky with a low density of bright stars, containing in this image approximately 10,000 galaxies. Now, of course, none of these were supposed to be there because this was too early for galaxies, so they had to redo all their theories. But this showed up 10,000 galaxies. This is just 1/10 of the diameter of the full moon, or an area smaller than a 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter square of paper held 1 meter away. And it took all those days for enough light to fall on their receptor to get this picture. And as you can see, there are spiral-armed galaxies here. There are globular galaxies. There's the mix of things which, of course, weren't supposed to be there. What are you looking at when you see this? What is this? Well, there's two answers to that question. The first answer is this, what the Bible says. The Bible says the heavens declare the glory of God. That what you're looking at here is what John said, the greatness of God on a scale that we can just barely imagine. Well, we can't. It's beyond us. That's one answer to this. But there's another answer, and that is summed up by Carl Sagan. The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. It just is what's there. God doesn't have anything to do with it. It's just stars. And our culture seems to be obsessed with trying to erase the possibility that this says something to us, that this picture has anything to say to us about who and what we are, that it's just star stuff. And we spend billions of dollars building super colliders. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars. Everything we put into space since the Apollo program has one goal in mind, and that is to prove that this picture has nothing to say about God. That's the whole stated goal of our space program. Now, things weren't always that way. As John said, people used to go out and look up at the sky and have the same reaction that you and I do. When we go out and you look up at the stars, what is the first thing you think? You think, wow, that's amazing. There's something inside of us is moved when we do that. But we're really bent on getting rid of this. And of course, the story that we're told to have this picture say nothing to us is the Big Bang. It's a universe where God isn't. And so how did we get there? How did we get to this? And here's the question we're going to talk about. Which universe do we really live in? Do we live in a universe that is always crying out about God, that is always telling us things about God? Everywhere you look, it's proof of God. Or are we just living in a universe where God doesn't have anything to do with that, that it all just runs like a clock, and God's nowhere to be found in it? And that's a question we're going to try to answer here very quick. And how did we get there? How did we get to this place where when we go outside and look up, very learned men are convinced that the universe has nothing to say to us? Well, as John said, it's kind of a recent thing. The ancient Greeks, of course, had the idea of a solar system, and then it was sort of lost. But in 1500, Copernicus kind of established back again that the sun was in the middle and things went around the sun. We didn't really understand how, but that's the way it worked. Then Kepler came along in 1620 and could write the equations for where the planets were going to be. Tell me what the date is, I'll tell you where the planets are. And so it was very well established that there was a solar system. By 1675, Newton came along, gave us the laws of gravity, refined Kepler's equations. By 1750, we found that there were more than stars or planets. A guy named Herschel, with the telescope, saw these fuzzy things. He didn't really know what they were, but it was clear they weren't a star and they weren't a planet, called a globular milkiness. And so we kind of got the idea that, wait a minute, there's more stuff out there than just our solar system, maybe. Now, 1830, this guy, Bessel came up with the first parallax way to measure distances, which is you take a picture of a star at one point in the year, and 6 months later, you take another picture of the star. The angles kind of tell you how far away things were. And he began to realize, wait a minute, we live in a big place. We didn't really know how big. It kind of went out to maybe 100 light years. It was big, but it wasn't real big. 1879, a guy named Michelson determined what the speed of light was. And in 1910, our buddy Einstein came up with relativity. Now, that was a real change in our thinking. Space and time were interrelated, things like that. So, 1920, a guy named Shapley mapped the universe. Now, but to Shapley, the universe was the Milky Way. Up until 1920, we had no idea that there was anything outside the Milky Way. And he mapped the Milky Way and kind of put us out on one of those arms. And so our understanding of the universe grew to that place. Then Hubble came along. And he got the Mount Palomar telescope, could finally see some stuff. And those milky things that guy had found, he resolved into galaxies, and we understood that there were things, groups of stars out there, like the Milky Way, that were way out there. And then, of course, Hubble did his famous thing where he discovered that the universe is expanding. He the whole redshift thing. And then a guy named Lemaître, however you say that, who's French, he said, well, you know what? If it's expanding and you wind it backwards, what you're going to end up with is the whole universe at one point. And the whole concept of a singularity was born. And then a guy named Gamow said, well, if that really happened and stuff expanded out of there, there ought to be this radiation that's left over from that, kind of the bang from the Big Bang. That's when the term got coined. Actually, the term was coined by a guy in derision. I can't think of his name right now. A very famous astronomer that was the steady state theory guy. And they said, if you run this backwards, you ought to see this. And then in 1965, Penzias and Wilson discovered this cosmic microwave background radiation. And everybody went, aha, that proves it. We live in a Big Bang universe. That's how we got here. That answers all the questions. And we didn't move into a Big Bang universe. We moved God out of the universe. And here's what Carl Sagan said. This book is also about God, or perhaps about the absence of God. A universe with no edge in space and no beginning or end in time and nothing for a creator to do. And this was in the preface to Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Space and Time. And voila, it's all been proven. It's a locked, airtight case. And we live in a Big Bang universe. And God, if he's there, certainly doesn't have anything to do with the universe we live in. And that's the myth that's told over and over and over. Well, what are we to make of this as Christians? What are we to think when our Bible tells us that things are different than that, that God is active and alive and well, but yet these people say they've proven that this can all happen without him? Is that true? Well, actually, no. There's, like most things, there's a lot of things we need to understand about how they arrived at this conclusion. The Big Bang is not science, even though many scientists believe in it. Now, why would I say that? It seems rather arrogant to say that. But we have to understand that Origins Anytime you're studying how things started, that is not empirical science. Most of you are probably going to university. You understand the scientific method. You propose an experiment. You set up the things, and you run it, and you see what happens. That's science. Origins is not science. You can't repeat it. You can't go back and look and see what happened. What it is forensic science. And if you watch those detective shows, you know, you come up with clues, and then you kind of extrapolate back what might have happened. And that's the kind of science any kind of origins research is. If you weren't there to see it, it's all circumstantial evidence. And you can come up with a plausible way it might have happened, but you really don't know if that's what happened unless you have an eyewitness. Now, we, of course, have an eyewitness, but they don't want to take his testimony. So it's very clear when people start talking about this, it's not really science. It's something else. It's not physics and chemistry. Now, there's physics and chemistry involved, but it's not science. It's based on a number of assumptions. Okay. The theory is based on a priori. A priori means without knowledge, before knowledge. It's like starting assumptions. All these big fancy equations these guys have to solve are called boundary value problems. And you can't solve them unless you assume the starting conditions. And that's why in that quote by Carl Sagan, he says, no edge and no center. Those are their starting assumptions to get the Big Bang. And they'll often talk about that, how the universe has no edge, no center. And those things are necessary, and they assume that that is the case. There's no way of knowing whether that's true. It's what you start with, that the universe is all there is. That's why Carl Sagan says the cosmos is all there is, because that's the way that makes the equations come out to give them the answer they want. If you put different starting assumptions in, you don't get a Big Bang. You get something different. Same equations, same science, you get a different answer, but it's not the answer that they want. So they also assume that materialism, that's their basic assumption, is the universe is all there is. Of course, we know that's not true. God exists. The cosmological principle, you'll hear this. Every time they tell you this myth, they're very clear on this. The universe is the same all over. We're not in a special place. Everything, and the cosmological principle says just that. There's nothing special about any place in space. Why do they say that? Well, that means there's no gravitational center to it. If there's a gravitational center to it, then some very different things happen. And the backward extrapolation of Hubble's discovery to a singularity. Now, this is the most important one. They say, well, if you run it backwards for 15 billion years, it all comes together. Well, they're assuming it's been around for 15 billion years. It could have been created in an expanding way less than 15 billion years ago, and then it wouldn't end up in a singularity, would it? So these are all conclusions that fall out of the beginning assumptions that they make. Okay, there's some other things. Science cannot explore, explain, or even conjecture about a singularity. What they'll say when you hear this story told over and over and over, and it's always told in the same form, like a myth, and what they're actually telling you when they tell you the Big Bang story is they're telling you all their assumptions. At every point where they're careful to say the same thing each time, that's an assumption they've had to make to get the result that they want. And the first, a singularity, they'll say the gravity didn't exist, the strong and weak nuclear forces did not exist, and magnetism did not exist. They were all together. It was too hot. It was all energy. Well, guess what? Everything we know about science doesn't work in those conditions. We have no way of knowing what would happen. Everything in science is based on those four forces. And they didn't exist. So we don't have any idea whether a singularity is possible. We don't have any idea what would happen in a singularity. And yet they want to tell us what happens at every microsecond past that. Well, it can't be, because all of our science doesn't work there. And it's all just based on assumptions they make to end up where they want to go. Okay, not only is it not scientific, It violates known science. To work out to where they want it to end up, they have to violate known science in very many ways. And the first step is the creation of matter. Because, as the story goes, as it cooled, it got cool enough for matter to form. And that's why they're building the super collider, because they're trying to recreate the conditions at the Big Bang. And, of course, Einstein told us that energy could become matter, right? And vice versa. That's how we get the atom bomb. But guess what happens every time energy turns into matter? Every time that happens, what science tells us is an equal number of matter and antimatter is formed. Well, if the entire universe was created with an equal amount of matter and antimatter, there would be no matter, because those two form back together and turn back into energy. And so what they say is, every particle out of a billion, there was an imbalance. Well, why do they say that? Well, because the only way we could have a universe is if that happened. But what science tells us is that never happens. What science tells us is it always creates both. And so they violate what they know is true about science to say, well, one out of a billion was extra matter, and that's why we have matter in the universe. Well, that's like saying, it could happen that one of you in this room would suddenly rise to the ceiling, that gravity, all the molecules in your body would work together to rise to the ceiling. But everybody knows it never happens. But it has to be that way to end up where they want to go. So the creation of matter is the first way that they do it. And the other one is this dark matter or dark energy. Now, dark matter and dark energy are matter and energy that we can't detect. And actually, what they say right now is that 96% of the universe is things that we can't detect. That only 4%, all those stars and galaxies, all that stuff is only 4% of what's out there. Okay. Really, the answer lies in 96% of the stuff being what we can't detect. Now, why do they think that's there? It has a lot to do with how the spiral arms of galaxies rotate. They don't follow Newtonian physics. The only way that things can be the way we see them, in their view, is that there's something that we can't see that's affecting it. Well, this is a very interesting thing, because we have been here before where things just didn't seem to make sense. How many of you know who this guy is? There you go. Now, why is he up here? Because the reason that Einstein developed the theory of relativity was because of the planet Mercury. The orbit of the planet Mercury did not follow Newtonian physics. There was something there. And so, do you know what the answer was? The planet Vulcan. The planet Vulcan was a planet that existed on the other side of the sun that we could never detect. And the reason that Mercury didn't orbit right was because there was this undetectable planet on the other side that was always somewhere where we couldn't see it, and that's what made Mercury go goofy. And there was scientific paper after scientific paper written about the properties of the planet Vulcan. Guess what? There was no Vulcan. The problem was our physics. The problem was our physics needed to change, and Einstein went, hey, wait a minute, it doesn't make sense that there's this undetectable thing that answers all the questions. We've got to be thinking wrong. And the same is true with dark matter. There are alternate views of origins where dark matter is not required. There's an alternate theory of gravity that it's actually a repelling force, not an attracting force, where you don't need dark matter to solve all the problems with all the equations. There's another guy named Carmelli who's come up with, like Einstein did, Einstein added a dimension of time to all his equations. Carmelli has added the dimension of the rate of expansion of the universe to his equations, and all his equations balance without using dark matter or dark energy. And I think it's very likely that in the next few years, people are going to start going, really? You got to have 96% of stuff that you can't see to make your equations balance? maybe we're not thinking straight. So we've been here before. And the other thing is the CMBR data, the cosmic microwave background radiation, which they talk about all the time. I'm sure you've seen this map. This is from the WMAP satellite. Has anybody heard of that? Anybody heard of the COBE satellite that they sent up? Well, the COBE satellite, the problem with the cosmic microwave background radiation is it's too smooth. You know, people will say, how can starlight get here if the Earth is 6,000 years old and it's 14 billion light years away? Well, there's an answer for that. But they have the exact same problem. So if anybody ever asks you that question and they're an evolutionist, just say, well, how do you solve it? Because the cosmic microwave background radiation is so smooth, it hasn't had time to be as smooth as it is. And so when they tell you the myth of the Big Bang, they always talk about the expansion period. You always hear that. Now, why? Because that solves this problem. The problem that things are too smooth. They say, well, okay, well, then in the very beginning, it expanded really fast. Well, it expanded faster than the speed of light, which is impossible in their physics. But it has to do that, or things can't be this smooth. And when they predicted it, and they sent the COBE satellite up, they couldn't detect any difference at all. And they wasted, I forget how many hundred million dollars on that satellite, because their prediction was so wrong that they had to make the WMAP satellite with a sensitivity 30 times greater to be able to find any differences at all. So they came back finding some differences, and they said, aha, we've got it. But then they analyzed the data. And you know what the data shows? The data does show differences in the cosmic microwave background radiation, but it didn't help them because it has a pole, north and south. And so their cosmological principle has been shown to be incorrect by this data. There actually is a center of the universe, is what the data shows. And it's pretty close to where we are. So there's lots of problems, and they have to take what they know about science and change it to keep track and to keep hold of the Big Bang. Star formation. Lots of stars in the universe, right? And, of course, how did they form? You've all seen these pictures. What's that? It's a star nursery, isn't it? I mean, you can go watch the Big Bang on YouTube. Just Google it. You can see it happen. And you can see this is a star nursery. And they would have us understand that stars are just popping out all over the place. Just little star babies being born everywhere. And Stephen Hawking's book, where he pretty much said he'd solved all the problems of the universe, in the back, however, he had a few notes of unsolved problems. And they listed the formation of galaxies and the formation of stars. They have no idea how stars can be formed. Because, see, the heavier elements, anything heavier than lithium, can't be formed except for by a star. As the star goes through nuclear fusion, heavier elements are formed. And then when they go supernova, those elements are kicked out into the universe. Well, but stars can't form unless there's another star to form a star. The only theory they have for how a star is formed is when one blows up, the expanding gas of clouds, or the expanding cloud of gas gets compressed. Because an expanding gas of clouds, or gas of, sorry, thank you very much. What happens to an expanding cloud of gas? Does it collapse on itself? No, it just keeps expanding, doesn't it? If you pop a balloon, is that gas in that balloon going to come back together, or is it just going to keep going? Especially when it's hot. And so they have a real problem. How do they get that cloud of gas to actually attract back to itself? Because the gas, what science tells us, there's equations for gas pressure, and those forces created by the gas pressure are greater than the gravitational forces. So there's no way to collapse them back in. So the answer is a star blows up and the compression wave comes in and makes a star. But where did we get the first stars? And that ultra-deep field tells us that 800 million years ago, according to their theory, there was lots and lots of galaxies formed already. 800 million years after the Big Bang, which, of course, doesn't work. The other thing is planetary formation. Here's a picture of planets forming right there, right? After that gas cloud compresses back into a star and it ignites, and that nuclear explosion takes off across the solar system. Of course, all that dust just stays there after a nuclear explosion. That happens a lot, doesn't it? After a nuclear explosion, the dust just stays around. And it's, then what happens? Well, we know it just goes around, around, around. Pretty soon it turns into planets, right? Well, they don't know how that could happen either. Because how do you take little bits of, even if you give them little bits of heavier metals, like nickel, which forms the core of the Earth, you have to get a whole bunch of nickel, planetary-sized chunk of nickel, to gather together and become hot enough to melt when it's out in interstellar space at about 3 degrees Kelvin. So look at the rings of Saturn. Those are chunks of rocks that are going around a large gravitational body. Do you think those are going to form into little moons? All those chunks of rock? Why would they stick together as they came together? Why would that happen? Well, science tells us, of course, it would not happen. These things would not take place. And so they really don't have any theory. If you really go into and you read these articles, at the end they go, we really don't have a good theory for how stars are formed. We really don't have a good theory for how planets are formed. And of course, I love this graphic because, you can get this on the internet too. Here it breaks down the Big Bang into, you know, 10 to the minus 43 seconds, and this is the inflationary period. And of course, what's this? This is the theory, of course. If the cosmos is all there is, what it says, of course, is that explosion produced you. And John will probably talk a little bit more about this, but is it really make any sense that hydrogen floating through interstellar space would turn into people? That's the theory. Hydrogen in interstellar space under the influence of nothing but gravity will eventually make people. Well, that's crazy. But that's what they want us to believe. So, I'm probably going too long. If it's not the Big Bang universe, if that's crazy, well, what universe do we live in? Well, this book comes up with the idea called the Thelain universe. And that's a Hebrew word, I believe, for the will of God. And I think as Christians, we need to understand, we can't mix these two ideas. These two ideas just cannot go together. But so often we try to just put God on top of a Big Bang universe. Like, there's the Big Bang universe, and then God's somehow outside of that, making it all go or something. These two ideas cannot go together. And as believers, we need to stop trying to make them go together. It's not a physical universe plus a spiritual. If the universe is the universe of the Bible, it is a spiritual universe, and that's all it can ever be. It is created and upheld by the Word of God. It's a spoken universe. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word... Whoops, I got to go back one. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and then it says, then God said. At every created act, God says. The universe didn't come from a singularity. It came from God speaking. Everything that happened was because God willed it and the Word of God created it. And then, of course, the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. The universe is inherently held together and runs by the Word of God. That's what the universe is at its essence. And it is reserved for judgment. It is created and upheld by the Word of God. And that means that Genesis is the literal, scientifically valid explanation of the unfolding of His will. Now, He did it in a physical way. And there's probably a scientific way for us to study and understand how it actually did come about. And lots of guys are doing that, and I don't have time to go into it all. It's fascinating. But the Genesis is valid. And so if that's true, does that reality test? If we really live in the universe that the Bible tells us about, what would we expect? Well, we would expect this. We would expect man to be central to the universe. One thing they, over and over, I just watched a couple documentaries on the Big Bang. Over and over, I think, I don't know how many times they told us, we're meaningless, we're pointless, there's nothing special about us. They go way out of their way to tell you that we aren't important in any way. But the Bible tells us that we are. That the universe exists for us. That God loves us. That we are unique, that there's nothing like us. We are made in the image of God. That's true, isn't it? I mean, we can imagine Spock and we can imagine green men, but there's no evidence that any of them exist. As far as we know, we are unique in so many ways. And where we live is unique. I don't have time, but there's a lot of reasons to believe that we are very near the center of the universe. Quantized redshifts, the W map. There's lots of reasons to think that actually we are at the gravitational center of the universe or very near, within 100 million light years, which is close in the galaxy, in the universe. And what we would see when we look at the world, as the Bible tells us, is that we would see this amazing, glorious thing, but it's broken. Well, isn't that what you see? I go out and I look up at the stars and I think, wow, I mean, you look at your hand and it's all amazing, but it's broken. That's what I would expect, and that's what I see. I would see decay, not self-organization. I don't see anything organizing itself and getting better. I mean, if evolution's true, then everywhere we look, everything ought to be getting better. Nothing's getting better. And we would see God actively at work. We would see a God who's not far away, but we would see a God who's actually at work in space and time. That's what I would expect by reading the Bible. Well, what do I see? For me, I see the promised Messiah fulfilled. I see right at the fall, God saying, I'm going to send a solution. I see God working for thousands of years with the nation of Israel. I see God keeping every promise He's made. And then the Savior comes and He dies. That's the universe I live in. That's reality. That to me is what happens. Which one is closer? I think hands down, what the Bible tells me about what I should see in the universe, that's what I see. I don't see this impersonal thing that's always getting better and gas organizing itself into people. I don't see that anywhere. And the only reason we'll believe it is because they said it happened 14 billion years ago. If they told you it happened last week, you'd laugh. But nothing's changed. The same laws of the universe are at work today. So, here we are, John Meyer. Where's John Meyer?
Again, some of you may be familiar with astronomy things. Some of you might be just a little bit mesmerized by facts that float by. But I want to tell you this. God tells us that the creation is the clearest, most straightforward place to see the reality of God. You and I live in a world where the story has been spun so that almost all of us feel insecure about that. We doubt that. And yet, there hasn't been a generation ever before that has known so much about the creation. So we have to be honest. One of two things is true. Either as we have learned more about the creation, the claim of the Bible has been shown to be wrong, which is the story, or if we look at it honestly, we should see really clear evidence of God, so clear that no one has ever seen it so clearly. Now, I don't know how many of you guys are engaged in science. A long time ago, I got a verse in the Bible that told me all about how the world views science and about evolution. And it's not in Genesis. It's in Proverbs. And it says this. One man seems right until another comes and examines him. What that means is I can make you believe anything I want as long as I'm the only voice speaking to you. If I'm the only voice, God promises us faith comes by hearing. God created you to believe what you hear. And we live in a culture that has flooded us with the words of faith. And that faith is there is no God and there is no evidence for a God. And most of us, even as believers, shake in our boots because we have that faith. Because we've heard it so much. And every night on television and every time we turn something on. And I hope you're one of those people that has engaged with this enough that you have been able to move past that. I know for me, God is really close. God is very real. Every time I look at a tree, I know God wrote the DNA in that tree. I know it. I can't deny it. I look at it and I go, oh my goodness, God, there you are. That's a really cool one. I know you did that. Because I have looked at the creation in an objective way. And what I have found is the very thing the Bible promises. And when I looked at the wonder and the glory and the amazement of our bodies and living systems, I just go, oh, my son had me look through his anatomy book a couple weeks ago, and he's in graduate school. And I hope he has the same experience. I open that book and my jaw just drops. I go, oh my goodness. Because I see kindness of God to me and giving me the body he's given me. I hope you can have that because God made the creation to give it to you. But we have to be careful because faith comes by hearing, and you can believe things that are, well, obviously lots of people believe things that are utterly untrue. The story between the universe being billions of years old and there being no God, and the story of the universe being 6,000 years old and there being a God, one of the things I love about that incredible contrast is that's got to be fairly testable. I got a universe that's a source of intelligence and it's 6,000 years old, and I got a universe that has no intelligence engaged and it's 13.78 billion years old. I go, you shouldn't have to look too long to figure out which of those two is wrong. And to be honest, many of us live with the great fear that the Bible is wrong in many places, about history, about many things, even though we are loath to say that at times, but we have that fear. And this has been the thing that's guided me as I've walked through some of these really hard questions and always come through very, very encouraged at the other end. Even though the world says there's great, great reason to doubt the Bible, this is my MO. I am going to act as if the Bible is true and then see if there's any evidence that could support that. Okay, we all know it's wrong, but let's just give it the benefit of the doubt and let's just test it. And one of the last areas I did that with in my life is the flood. Okay, you know, All the animals on the ark, the little giraffe with his head out, come on. You know, we all know that's not true, right? And yet I've told people it's true for a long time, but do I really, really? I mean, like the difference between Mitch, you know, Mitch's teaching this morning, which was so good, about gnosis and epinosis, or that was somebody else, but knowledge and conviction. I speak with knowledge when I lay in my bed at night. What do I know? And in so many areas, I've moved from that area of knowledge to conviction, from gnosis to epinosis, if that's the right use of those words, in areas related to science and origins. So I want to just give you a few things about the flood. And I only have a few minutes, and I will do my best to not use more than that. And I'm just going to give you one principle. And in our church, we do 6 weeks classes, and then we take a field trip to Moab. And it's really fun. You want to go to Moab? I'll show you the flood. And you're going to see a couple of pictures from there. But I'm just going to give you one principle we share in our class. So let's see if this is working here. Okay. One principle based on an understanding of two concepts. Two possibilities to explain the surface features of the earth. It comes from one or two places. It comes from something called uniformitarian processes, and that would be the common belief. And again, okay, I speak with a lot of simplicity, a lot of confidence, very, very directly, that I believe there's a flood. I recognize in this room, to many of you, to some of you at least, that might be the craziest idea you've ever heard. In my church, I tell people, if you know what I believe, and you don't know what I know, and you don't think I'm crazy, you're not thinking very clearly. Did you understand that? If you know what I believe, and I believe in the flood, and I believe a 6,000-year-old universe, and you don't know what I know, and you don't think I'm crazy, you're not thinking very clear. Because if all you know is what the world's ever told you, and that's your view of knowledge, and you recognize that I'm saying the universe is 6,000 years old and there was a worldwide flood, if you don't think that's crazy, you're not thinking. I respect your place to think and challenge. We cannot believe this blindly. But understand, there are people who have thought it through and feel very confident and very much at peace that there are very good reasons to believe the Bible is a historical document. If you don't know that information, then in many ways you should greatly question it. We are not here to mindlessly accept some doctrine. All I want to know is what's true. If it's not true, I don't want to believe it. So I just share that. I speak all this stuff very, you know, simplistically and directly. If you come up afterwards and say, John, I think you're an idiot. What about this? What about this? What about this? I'll go, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for honoring me enough to believe that I might have thought this through. So I'm just telling you what a very high level of where I've come. So, uniformitarian principles. This is what you learn in geology class. And all it says is that the present is the key to the past. A guy named Lyell, I think, coined that phrase several hundred years ago. And what that means is the wind and the rain and the things we see happening around us, the seasons, they're what has made everything that we see over millions of years. The processes that work around us today over eons of time have created the features we see today on the earth. And this idea was developed in the late 1700s, early 1800s in the field of that became geology. Seasonal changes, wind, rain, sun, very slow geologic movements all explain the surface of the earth. The present is the key to the past. But there's another theory or way to look at forces in action, and that could be called catastrophism. And catastrophism says the past is the key to the present. In other words, you can't look at the present and figure out why it is. There's a key in the past. There's something that happened in the past that's very different. And that very different thing is why things are the way they are today. And without this very different thing in the past, present things would never exist. The past is the key to what we look at today. Not the present. The present would never make what we see today. Only something special and unique in the past, a catastrophe, would make what we see today. So, unique catastrophic events produce the major features of the Earth's surface. Present uniformitarian processes are erasing those features. They're going away because they were made by this unique catastrophic event, and that event is over, and so now what's happening is they're gradually being erased. The Bible says there has been one primary catastrophic event creating an aftermath, creating with an aftermath of smaller ones. So, and that one event was the flood. Worldwide year-long flood of Noah. That's the historical claim of the Bible. All right. So how do we determine which of these two fundamental shaping mechanisms is primarily responsible for the surface features of the Earth? So we look out at the Earth, we see lots of interesting things, big canyons and cliffs and all kinds of wild rocks and stuff like that. How do we explain those? Because every single feature you look at on the surface of the Earth, every single one of them is a result of a process. Something made them that way. Every time you look at something, you can go, wait a minute, something made it that way. What made it that way? What was the process that made that thing? Everything you see had a process. Was it a uniformitarian process, or was it a catastrophic process? And the truth is, after you begin looking and asking that question and looking at something, sometimes you can go, you know what, I really can't really tell. But there are times where when you put that question in your mind, you look at it and you go, you know what? I think I can tell. And this is the question we ask. In this class, we do a number of things like this. This is one of the things that we go through and teach ourselves, and it's perhaps the simplest one. Is time making this feature, or is time erasing this feature? When you go home, stick that in your brain, and especially if you're going west, far enough, you'll have real easy ways to apply this. So, is time making this feature, or is time erasing this feature? So, let me just give you a couple pictures here. We're not going to see them all, but I'm going to click through some of them. All right, so this is on the way to Capitol Reef National Monument. This is on a sabbatical that I took earlier, or about a year ago. There's the windshield of my motorcycle. Here's some cliffs. See these cliffs? Now, these cliffs are interesting features. We can ask ourselves a question. Is time making that cliff, or is time erasing that cliff? Now, these cliffs, they go for, I don't know, miles. And what's time doing to that cliff? Is time making that cliff? Where do you see the evidence of slow, gradual change over time? Oh, right down here. Right down here. This is the evidence of slow, gradual change over time. Where did that little rock right there used to be? Well, it probably used to be right about there or right about there. And where's this little rock going to be in a few years? Well, it's going to be right down there. And what's this cliff going to turn into? A nice rounded hillside. Time does not make cliffs. Time does not make canyons. Time makes nice smooth hillsides with trees on them. This is an amazing set of cliffs and relatively soft sediment in a very dry and arid area. And these cliffs are gradually being erased. And in I don't know how long, 1,000 years or so, you won't see any cliffs there anymore because time erases cliffs. And here's another picture of them. They're going away. Well, then what made them? What made that cliff? Time didn't make that cliff. A huge water event made that cliff. That's the only thing that would make it. Here's another one. Monument Valley. Famous Monument Valley Buttes. And we'll see a lot of pictures of Monument Valley here. Now, obviously, at one time, all of this area in here was what? It was all dirt. All of it clear over there. See those cliffs over there? This was all filled with dirt. These are, I don't know, 1,000 feet high. There's a little tiny car down there. I mean, these are huge. All of this has been eroded and removed. So this was all dirt at one time, and it's all been eroded away. Has it been eroded away by lots of wind, and has a stream carried the little rocks away gradually over time, millions of years? Well, there's several problems with that. One, there isn't any river anywhere. No riverbed, no ancient riverbed, nothing but flat plain. Where did all that dirt go? Is time making those buttes? Or is time erasing those buttes? Well, we can look again at these buttes. Now look again, look at all this empty area. Astonishing. It's all gone. Where is it? I mean, when we look at this butte, we begin to notice as we train our eye what to look for. What do we see? Well, first of all, we see this area around it. It's all completely gone. And when we look at the butte, at the base of the butte, it looks almost like it's been swept completely clean. I mean, we see the layers here. There is no debris. There's no like, all these rocks, where did they go? They're gone. They're miles, and wherever they are, they're hundreds of miles away. What took all this dirt and moved it hundreds of miles? But wait a minute. Oh, no. We see some evidence of time, don't we? Right here. Here's a little debris that's washed down. Okay, there's beginning to be little piles of debris at the bottom. Yeah, there's some stuff. This, you know, it used to be right here, and now it's there. Okay, there is some stuff falling down. We see evidence of time. And we see evidence of some process that utterly, absolutely swept this completely clean. It looks like it was swept as clean as the kitchen floor. And then some time ago, that process that was washing and washing and washing stuff away, away in some huge cataclysm suddenly stopped. And this is what was left. And it didn't quite get it erased. And the water was gone. And it was over. And what was standing in the middle of this vast, open expanse is a handful of buttes that didn't quite get washed away 4,000 years ago. And now in this dry, arid area, a few things have washed down and beginning to pile up. And at one day, this whole butte will be just a little mound, because time is not making this butte. Time is erasing this butte. Here's right outside Monument Valley. Again, what do we see? Nice, clean. It's like it's scoured clean, but there's some debris. There are some places where it's washed down. Yeah, a little bit. Beginning to cover up the nice, clean, sharp edges that were created by what? If it really was some vast water event, which it had to be, and there's no riverbed anywhere around here, that water event was so huge, how do we explain it? It has to be a worldwide event. Monument Valley again, absolutely flat floor. What in the world left these things? How long, how many millions of years have those been standing there? Is time making those or is time erasing those? Well, let's come back in 100 years and look. Here's Monument Valley. Here's the three buttes. This is an aerial view, and you can see some other buttes down here. It's sort of hard to pick this out. I wish I had more time, but these are the high areas. And again, this is just all flat. Here's another major butte area here. Vast, vast amounts of space. All this has been washed away. It's all gone. Not a sign of any river or flow area, some huge, massive water event flowed through here for a very short period of time when there was an uplift and washed this all away. And who knows where this is? Again, Monument Valley, look how clean it is. Is time making this? Is time making this nice, clean edges, or is time erasing this? And as your eye gets trained to ask that question, it becomes more and more obvious. Here's Monument Valley from a distance. Time is not making these features. They're going away. All right, so what's this? All right, so we'll shoot through this. Grand Canyon. According to the most recent theories, Grand Canyon is somewhere between 5 million and 70 million years old. 5 and 70 million. Understand this, 5 million years is a long time. Now, don't let Charlie fool you with those big numbers of billions. We're now in geology. 5 million years is a long time. It's a lot of winters, it's a lot of summers, it's a lot of rain, it's a lot of wind. A lot of change happens in 5 million years. According to the youngest age for this canyon, 5 million years ago, maybe 70, but 5 million years ago, the river started up here and it gradually cut its way down. And now 5 million years later, there it is down there at the bottom of the canyon. Okay. We can ask ourselves, is there any way we could kind of evaluate that? And actually, there's a bunch of ways, but I'm just going to show you one. So, we have 5 million years of erosion up here. We have almost no years of erosion down here because this is where it's new. So that means when we look at the top of the canyon, it should be way more eroded. It should be way more like a nice smooth hillside than the bottom. But when we look at the Grand Canyon, what do we see? It is exactly the same amount of erosion. We have an utterly flat plateau. It's all cut through. No signs of erosion up there. That's as flat as a pancake. And all of this, every edge from the top to the bottom has exactly the same amount of erosional evidence. Nice, clean, sharp edges up here at the top. None of this should exist. None of these nice, sharp, clear edges, they shouldn't be there. You can see evidence where they're eroding away, just like you see evidence at the bottom of it eroding away. It was all made at the same time. Why can't people see that? Because they already have their story. Utterly clean. 5 million years worth of erosion, really? It absolutely is no different anywhere throughout the canyon. Now, there, and that one, you see a little bit of erosion in the past, don't you? Back up there. We don't know if we need to see it. See right there. Okay, we're getting a little bit of erosion, aren't we? Right there. Oh, it used to be right up there. Now it's down there. But why is all this so clean? It's like this is scoured. Some process has ripped this out. And they know where this dirt is. You know where this dirt is? They know where it is. They found it. This is in Southern California. That's where the dirt from the Grand Canyon is. It's in Southern California. They know where it's at. Really, one grain at a time, a little bit of wind, a little bit of rain, and none of it's here at all. I'm not here at all. Those little grains, the little raindrops, they picked it up and they carried it all the way to Southern California. No, they carried it right here. This is where it went, and this is where it's going. And if we came back, and there's some more here, a little erosion. There's little erosional piles down here at the bottom. This is all going to fill up. It's going to be a nice hillside with nice little trees on it. Sometime in the future, because time did not make this. Time is erasing it. How hard does it have to be to figure that out? Here, you know what this is? This is in Moab, Canyonlands. That is a waterfall. How many of you guys knew that? That's a waterfall. It is a dry waterfall. That is what happens when huge amounts of water rush over a hard rock surface. This is exactly what's happening in Niagara Falls today. And it breaks away the edge. And when it breaks away the hard edge, it cuts deep down and makes a canyon. This, everyone agrees, is formed by water. How? Was there some river that came up here and gradually cut that out? No. It happened because huge amounts of water were rushing down here. Well, maybe someday there was some ancient river a long, long time ago. No, the drainage basin is right here. When you stand at this spot where I took this picture and you look at this, this water comes out of nowhere. And it has cut these huge gorges, and then it cut and it cut and it cut, and then boom, it's gone. The water's over. And what's left is this massive dry waterfall. And here it is down farther. And it leaves all these little things that are going away, they're going away, they're going away, they're going away, and then boom, the water's gone, it's over. And that's what's left. Time did not make these. Time is erasing them. Look at that thing. Really? For millions of years, that has stood there. Could fall down tomorrow. It was formed because massive amounts of water were rushing around, cutting, 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 and that's what was left in the swirling water of a flood, and then the water was gone. A catastrophe started and it stopped. Here's the drainage basin. This is where all that water would have come from, really. And you know what? Look, there's not even any rivers. See any rivers going into these? Oh, yeah, look at the millions of years of rivers. No rivers. No stream beds, no gullies, no nothing. Now, here we do have a little bit of a gully. What is that? That's time. That's rain, water over time. This is evidence of uniformitarianism. That's a uniformitarian phenomenon right there, and you can completely tell the difference. What cut all of this out? Was it really that little stream over millions of years that then cut this dry waterfall? And you just have to look, and you got a brain. You ask the question, and you look at this thing, and you look at this thing, and you look at this thing. This is a dry waterfall. You know what that is? That's the largest waterfall in the world. You are looking at the largest waterfall in the world. You know what that is? Who knows what that is? Dry Falls, Washington. That's the largest waterfall in the world. It goes way around here. There's not a drop of water that goes over it. Largest waterfall in the world. And we know that this waterfall made in solid basalt. This is solid volcanic basalt. We know it was made in an afternoon. One afternoon cut. This is, I don't know how, this is 1,000 feet or something like that. Cut the largest waterfall in the world one afternoon through solid volcanic basalt. I had to go see this. Patrick Nuri took me to this. And he's the guy that knows all about the flood. So I had to see, because when you look at features of this, it looks just like Utah, just like Utah, all the stuff in Utah, only this is not sandstone. This is not sedimentary rock. This is solid volcanic basalt. Can water cut things in solid basalt? And scientists know that this was formed by a dam breach from Lake Missoula in the Ice Age. No one believed it for many years, but it's been proven. Everyone agrees now, and the guy who finally figured it out was famous. And this is formed through a catastrophe. Here's the canyon formed in that afternoon. They think the water ran for several hours. Here's another picture of it. Here's the canyon. It looks just like a canyon in the southwest, only this is solid basalt. Here's a butte formed near there out of that flood. I took this picture. I thought this is amazing. Solid basalt again. And we see here a little debris that's come down, carved in that flood in an afternoon. And that looks amazingly like that, which is right near Moab, Utah. Everyone now has to agree that the first picture was formed in a catastrophe. But none of those people would believe this was formed in a catastrophe. This is millions of years, over eons of time, one raindrop at a time. I do see evidence of time right there. I see evidence of catastrophe right here. And this is, again, Dry Falls. This is a butte. If you see this, it looks so much like what's in Utah. And here's another example. This is up in that same area formed by Lake Missoula Dam Breach in the afternoon. This is all cut through solid basalt, and it looks just like what you see down in Utah, only this was formed from a dam breach in the ice age, and it's in solid volcanic basalt. This is, again, at Canyonlands. This is all dry waterfalls from a huge rush of water that rushed off and cut these. It is not streams over time. And I could just show you so much more in all these pictures, but I don't have time. Last thing, we'll end with this. This is right near my house. Interesting features. These are called hogbacks. There's a house down there, a farmhouse, so these are great big structures. Notice the mountains are over here. This is right at the foothills. And these are very common all over the world. I've seen them all lots of places. They always face upward toward mountains. And they're rounded. They're great big features. Some aren't as big, but they're rounded. They're clearly formed by water, and there's water cuts through them. Oftentimes, there aren't even streams that run through these. Often, this times a stream will run down in front of them. It'll go down horizontally. And we see them here. And the longer you look at this picture, it's sort of like, where's Waldo? They're just everywhere in these pictures. Fort Collins, where I live, is right here. So this is the mountains, the Rocky Mountains, the foothills right here. And again, you just see these everywhere. And I just wish I had more time to go through them, but I don't. This picture shows a bunch of them. Here's some little ones. They're all rounded uphill. They're all clearly rounded by water. And they have water cuts through them. Here again, here's a farmhouse. These are very large structures. Here's a whole bunch of them over here, littler ones. And what it looks like for all the world, what it looks like is a huge, huge amounts of water came rushing off these mountains as if they had been rapidly pushed up with water on top of them. And these layers go way down under the earth. These are sedimentary layers that have been pushed up, broken through the surface, and somehow as they broke through the surface, they have been washed by vast amounts of water and they have been carved into these hogbacks. So here's a picture at a little farther distance. Here's the foothills. We can see some hogbacks here. Here's some here. Here's a sediment, like a sediment pool right in front of them where sediment has settled. Let me get to a good picture, and we'll pause, and I'll close. All right. So, well, we can stop here. Okay, so we got hogbacks in the front of this picture. If you look, you see them here. You see them here. They're all down through there. They were all on the Front Range. These mountains are very different. I will only say this. I asked a geologist one time, how in the world do you explain these? And they said, well, you know, streams came down and gradually cut through there over time. And I said, well, but there's no stream that comes down into them now. And they said, well, there used to be streams. And I said, really? So there was a stream that came out of the mountains, and it went here, and there was another stream that went there, 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 and there was another stream that went there. Really, there were all those streams when there's no valleys leading into them? Well, yeah. I said, I think I have a better explanation. What this looks like is I have huge structures that have been formed by massive amounts of water that was suddenly there and suddenly gone. And it's right by my house. And it fits exactly with what geologists describe in flood theory today on how the flood happened and what caused it and how the mountains rose up. It fits exactly. Time is not making those features. Time is erasing them. They were formed by something else. And one of the things I like about the flood is it's this wild, fantastic claim, supposedly. Isn't that fantastic once you get it in your head? But once you start looking, there's evidence everywhere. And let me just close with this. Why does this matter? Are we just trying to be the guys that have the right science answers? No. Why this is so important is if there was a flood about 4,400 years ago on this earth, and if the whole planet is covered with clear evidence of that flood, then God is saying to you and me, I have been here, and I have judged you for your sin. And I have told you that I'm going to judge again.
and I have left clear evidence all over the surface of your planet that I've done it once. And you need to believe me when I tell you I'm going to do it again. And when that becomes more than a theological story, when that becomes something that you believe, when you lay in your bed at night, it changes your faith. And God becomes tangible. And God becomes real. That's why God gave it to us. That's why everyone that gets into this subject wants to talk about it, wants to share it, because the God who hung on the cross for us has revealed himself as real in a way that makes the cross very powerful. And that's why it's worth your time to look at the incredibly good resources available from all kinds of places that help you know that when you lay in bed at night. So let me pray. Lord Jesus, thank you, God, for who you are. I just praise you that you're a real God. Lord, there's so many things we struggle with and wrestle with, even in our own lives. And our feelings and our emotions and our whatever seem so huge. We need to know that there's a real God. And we're supposed to take this message to the world. And the world doesn't want different parts of it. And we need to know there's a real God. And you want us to know that. And you've made it clear. And I pray you give us, each one of us, that strength that you put the creation here to give us, that we'd have it. And whether anybody listens or not, there'd be a peace in our own heart. Oh my goodness, I live in God's world. Help us with that, Lord. Let us see you in all the glory you want to be seen in. In Jesus' name, amen. Wow. I knew we could not do the history of America and the history of Russia in an hour and 15 minutes. But thanks for letting us go long.